This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The effort to repeal and replace Obamacare is down for now, but is it out? What does the future of healthcare look like for 1.7 million Floridians who signed up for insurance under the Affordable Care Act? And if Congress instead moves to fix Obamacare, what part could Senators Bill Nelson and Marco Rubio play? Chris Carmody is a shareholder with Gray Robinson. He's a Republican political consultant. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Absolutely.
Also joined by Dick Batchelor, former Florida state lawmaker, also a Democratic political analyst. Thank you so much, Dick.
Thank you.
So I want to start by just talking a little bit about the reaction to the defeat of the Obamacare repeal. Chris Carmody, is this a victory really for folks here who've been lobbying against this repeal, or is it just a pause?
Can I say both? After you got through the gladiator memes of John McCain's thumb down and everything, if you're arguing against, it's definitely a victory. Last year, there were over 1.7 million Floridians signed up through the health exchange of ACA. This year, there were 9 insurers that already had published rates with Office of Insurance Regulation for individual plans. So there's people who were already banking on this surviving and so, or preparing at least for it. And for those who prepared for it, they're probably very much relieved. The insurers who made their business plans accordingly, and the 1.7 million Floridians and probably more going into next year just on the individual plans, not to mention business. But it is, in some regards, a pause. President Trump doubled down on his rhetoric as far as getting some kind of repeal, whether it's a skinny repeal or not. And most of the Republicans involved in the process, other than the 3 that voted against it, have said they're committed to fix it. An interesting note, and I'm sure Dick will want to chime in on this, Bill Nelson, ironically, has been getting a lot of attention as a result of this because of his interesting relationship with Maine Senator Collins and how they've kind of created this moderate coalition to try to figure out, meeting before the vote, meeting since, both former insurance commissioners of their states, they might lead the path to getting something done in the middle.
Dick Batchelor, is that how you see it? Do you see Senator Bill Nelson as one of the key figures in this piece?
I think so, along with Senator Collins, as Chris said, too. I think there's an opportunity for a compromise now that the Senate has failed to repeal Obamacare. I think that they've got to do something. I would hope that the president's not going to fulfill his promise, or his threat, I guess it would be, that he was going to basically suspend the subsidies, basically try to do what he can as president under Secretary Price at HHS to basically disrupt the markets even more, which would be very unfortunate. The fact, the reason it keeps failing is because every bill they come out with uninsures between 26 and 32 million people. The fact is, people have that insurance today. It's not the way it should be. It should be changed. But again, I'm back to the point. I think there is an opportunity for compromise, but I really hope the president does not withhold the subsidies in the marketplace, because that would disrupt the markets totally.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask, too, about our other senator here in Florida, Senator Marco Rubio. He made a claim in a Facebook message that Florida actually mandates more coverage than Obamacare. This was checked by PolitiFact, rated mostly false, because they're saying that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, actually has a broader mandate than Florida. I mean, what actually would happen to those 1.7 million customers if Obamacare was repealed?
They'd be out of insurance. They would be without coverage. If you look at some of the proposals in the Senate, though, you had a proposal for what they call this kind of scaled-back skinny version. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it, that was a policy that covered very little. The deductibles were extremely high, and the copayments were extremely high, so really almost non-usable. But the other attendant issue on this is the whole Medicaid cuts in Florida. You know, that would really impact Florida a great deal, because there are about 800,000 people would be covered with a Medicaid expansion. We don't have the Medicaid expansion. So you look at really worsening the case.
Chris Carmody, that Medicaid expansion, how important is that, kind of thinking about all the details if Obamacare is repealed, if there's some kind of change to the way it's insurance is done here in Florida?
Well, if it was repealed, the good news is Florida wouldn't have a whole lot of adjustments, because we have not expanded Medicaid as half the states have. But Florida, like any state, will be in a position because, as we said, 1.7 million are already participating in that. Some would obviously find other forms of insurance. But what it comes down to, and why Senator Rubio was frustrated on coverage or not coverage, is until they can get the the rates of increase year over year on the insurance premiums under control this year. Of those nine, I said had published rates for this year, an average rate of increase of 17.8%. Until they can figure out a way to stabilize that, they will continue to be both a Democratic, moderate, and Republican call for some sort of repeal slash fix.
And does it look more like a fix at this point to you?
I think so. I think there's going to be Republicans that are going to, you know, from their cold, dead hands, say, we're not going to go away from this repeal. But there's others, based on this vote that went down, that will say, we have to do something. And I think if you poll Americans, or they have polled Americans, pre-existing conditions is something that we'll have to tell our kids and grandkids how it never existed before in insurance coverage, because most people say it's got to stay. Mm-hmm. Everyone is affected by someone, or has someone in their family that's affected by that. But the rates and such, that's what needs to be fixed. So pre-existing conditions, I think, will be something that Democrats and Republicans find common ground on. And then it's just a matter of what do you do to tweak the law on certain coverage areas to help just stabilize those rates.
Let me switch gears now, and let's talk about Stephanie Murphy, U.S. Representative Stephanie Murphy's seat. She's a freshman, a Democrat here in Central Florida. Challenges, though, there are some people lining up saying they're interested in taking a run at this seat. Chris Carmody, David Simmons, is he one of the contenders here?
Well, he's 95% in, according to the articles. I think David wants to do it and will do it. He's based in Seminole County. He's been on the ballot up there as a Republican for, it seems, for the last 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. Very well liked. Has a moderate position. Certainly he's taken his conservative positions as a Republican, but I think he can appeal to the moderate base. But there are others, as we all know. Representative Mike Miller has also jumped in. He's, in a way, kind of a unicorn in the Republican Party. His House district was, he was the only Republican in that district that did better than the Democrat. Orange County has long since gone the Democratic side, so no surprise that Hillary beat Trump. But even Patrick Murphy, who was at that point when the elections came around, it was fait accompli, he was going to lose to Rubio. He beat Rubio by 4 or 5 points. Miller was the only one that actually won in that district. So in a lot of ways, he's viewed as this unicorn of sorts, if he can beat Democrats in a sort of swing seat. But I think depending on who gets out of the primary, Simmons or him will both line up well against Congresswoman Murphy.
Dick Batchelor, if you were running Stephanie Murphy's re-election campaign, who would you be looking at with most interest here?
Well, first of all, we refresh our memories that she beat a 24-year incumbent. So obviously, she obviously has a lot of prowess. But also, we had to attend to that was about $5 million of campaign expenditure. So obviously, the question is the DCCC going to really line up behind her this time and put that kind of money in the race?
Why wouldn't they?
Well, I think they will. Right now, Charles Cook calls it a toss-up race, so it's going to be a very competitive race. Republicans are going to put a lot of money in this race. Mike Miller used to work for Congressman McCollum, so he's got some background in the Congress. He's been a very effective freshman legislator. But David Simmons has been there, as Chris said, for a very long time. Number one was a House member, then senator. But there was some discussion about him maybe running for Attorney General for the state of Florida. Hmm. But it looks like he's leaning, as Chris said, maybe 95% towards getting the congressional race. So if he does, it's strong because his district really makes up a lot of that congressional district. So he'd be a strong candidate.
So this could be a pretty interesting Republican primary.
Very interesting.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, political consultants Dick Batchelor and Chris Carmody. Well, let's talk about South Florida for a minute. Republican Jose Felix Diaz and Democrat Annette Tadeo in a special election. Tell me about the election. What's going on here and what's the significance for the state?
So that is a special election to replace Frank Artiles, who resigned during session this past year. By the numbers, that is a Democratic seat. Mm-hmm. Frank Artiles went up against Dwight Bullard in the last election cycle. So that is a primarily Hispanic Democrat seat. Mm-hmm. Dwight Bullard is an African-American, now former senator. You could get into the weeds of, did he campaign hard enough? Many thought that Senator Bullard wasn't campaigning very hard, not to mention demographically, he didn't necessarily fit that Senate district, whereas Frank Artiles from that district worked very hard. Mm-hmm. Sort of the hard charging style that got him elected is what also led to his demise, you could argue. And here we are now. You still have a Democratic seat by the numbers that leans Hispanic, which many argue will make it a little easier for Annette Tadeo. I know Jeff Clemons, the state senator from South Florida, he's running the campaign coffers for the Democratic Party. They're going to put quite a bit behind her. And I think if the election was today, it was probably hers to lose just based on numbers mm-hmm. and who's going to show up. That being said, Jose Pepe, as many know him at Tallahassee, Diaz, he is one of the hardest working members in the, formerly in the House before he resigned, now maybe in the Senate. He's going to work it very hard. He's going to get a lot of money, both from the party, from Senate majority and others. And it's going to be a fight down there. There's going to be a lot of ads. It'll probably get nasty. I've already seen that the Democrats have already started to run with the fact that he was on The Apprentice with our current president when he was just a television host back then. They're going to take advantage of that, and they're going to try to make this a referendum in many ways about Trump and to see how he plays down there.
Dick Batchelor, what does it mean for the Democrats if they get the seat back?
Well, today it would be the first female Hispanic in the Senate, which would be so a historical opportunity for those in the Hispanic population, number one. But number two, getting back to Diaz's campaign, keep in mind, he spent $2 million. He spent $2 million in a Senate race, in a local race, which is an amazing amount of money. So even though the numbers tend to be Democratic, if he can raise another $2 or $3 million, I mean, obviously that is that's an indicator that he can do very, very well. Also, unfortunately, she's got some bad press, and I hope she can work it out. But basically, they came out in the media, which is never good, that American Express wants $38,000 that she owes them. And I can see now an ad: if you can't be physically responsible, you know, how can you govern? So I can see that. Hopefully, she'll get that resolved. But it's there. It's out now. It'll be in the campaign fodder that goes out. But it's going to be. I agree with Chris. It's going to be a very close race. But the Republicans will spend a tremendous amount of money in that race.
Yeah, they'll probably double what they spent in that primary. Yeah. Now he was taking on a bit of a family legacy in the Diaz de la Portilla. Many of them had been. Alex was a former senator coming back. His brother had served Senate previously. So it was money well spent, because name ID again, right. At the beginning of that special primary, Diaz was down and he knew it. He had to fight in there. So it'll be a tough one. A fun fact in that House district that Jose Diaz left open, it was Jose Malia and Daniel Perez. Malia was endorsed by Jeb Bush, which is usually the gold standard down there. And he out-fundraised Perez, but Perez ended up winning pretty handily with less money. So that's an interesting signal of shifts down there in South Florida. A lot of folks didn't see that one coming.
I want to finally ask about the governor's race. Speaking of money, Dick Batchelor, how much money has been raised by some of these Democratic candidates? Is it enough? How much more do they need?
Not as enough as Adam Putnam's raising. He's raising about $13 million, I think, so far. So the Democrats haven't raised that much money. Gwen Graham seems to be ahead with about $2.5-3 million. Philip Levine, the mayor of Miami Beach, he's put it over two of his own money in the race.
Is he actually an official candidate yet?
He's not an official candidate yet, but he's certainly making all the noise about it. He's got a pack. He's raised his money. And the question about the mayor is whether or not he's willing to spend any of his personal net worth, which is estimated to be about $100 million. Andrew Gillum, the mayor of Tallahassee, kind of got off a good start, got some good press, only raised about $750,000. And all of a sudden, a story comes out that the FBI wants to talk to him and his staff about some shenanigans, alleged shenanigans at City Hall in Tallahassee. Well, obviously, your fundraising stopped. I think he raised no money for 1 month, and $10,000 came in one check the second month. So he's not raising any money right now. Anytime you mention FBI and candidate, people tend to steer far and wide and far away. Chris King has raised some money, but he's putting a lot of his own money in that race, too. He started out with $1 million in the race. He's from the Winter Park, Orlando area. But he's traveling the state a great deal and getting a lot of coverage, so he's out there. But in the end, you know, you're talking about a race combined that's going to be at least $100 million. So $1 million here and $1 million there doesn't do anything. It gets back to, I think, Gwen Graham, because of her father being Senator Bob Graham, Governor Bob Graham. She has a name recognition. She'd only served one term in the Congress and decided not to run because they reapportioned her out, essentially. But I think name recognition, not number one right now, she puts her up. But Mayor Levine, if he gets in the race and willing to spend some of his personal net worth, then it could be a very, very strong challenge in the primary.
Chris Carmody, Adam Putnam, has he made any missteps so far? Is he doing okay?
You could argue he's made some missteps. He is the front runner, and he's got, I think, $11 million on hand. He's raised about $15 million, spent some of that in the early month to get his name out. There's, you know, he knows he's going to get flanked on the right. Richard Corcoran has almost all but entered into the race. He said he won't announce until after session, but he raised $2 million in his watchdog pack. He'll probably raise more these coming months. Ron DeSantis, congressman from the Daytona Beach, Flagler area, a committee tied to him by his former chair of a previous committee, has over $1 million in the bank. Corcoran's got 2+ million. We'll continue to get more as he gets close to session and continues to fundraise. So those are two on the right of Putnam. And then you've got Jack Latvala, probably on the left of Putnam in the Republican Party. He's the Senate Appropriations Chairman, longtime legislator from Pinellas County. He's got 3+ million in his political committee. And his between he and his son and their tweets and their social media, it's pretty clear where he's headed. Sometime in August or early September, he'll announce for the gubernatorial race. And so here's Putnam in the middle. So has he had missteps? No major ones, but he's trying to figure out that fine line of being right, hence talking about NRA and guns on campus, which also kind of alarmed a few people. A lot of folks had never seen him take that position. And I saw recently he had his tweets about fake news and CNN and such, which again, you can agree with him or disagree with him, but some people say, do you need to do that right now? The primary is not for another year. But they're looking at numbers. They're going across the state, and they have to walk that fine line of trying to keep the right shored up and not let some of his congressional votes get in the way of that, and but also not lose the left, which probably is going to be more in line to go with him to someone like Latvala.
Well, Chris Carmody is a shareholder with Gray Robinson, a Republican political consultant. Thank you so much, Chris.
You're welcome.
Also joined by former Democratic state lawmaker Dick Batchel, now Democratic political analyst. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, the number of pregnant women addicted to opioids is growing.
This is our bubonic plague, our cholera, our Spanish flu. And how our medical community and communities at large react to it is really going to show our mettle and how it will be how we are judged in the future.
So what options do addicted pregnant women have for recovering and detoxing, and what happens post-pregnancy? Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida's opioid epidemic triggered a public health emergency. Dr. Pamela Carbina says it's the modern-day equivalent of the Spanish flu or bubonic plague. Carbina helps treat the pregnant and addicted and mothers going through detox with their newborn babies. In Volusia and Flagler counties, where she works, the number of newborn babies detoxing from opioids has doubled in the last 5 years. And at any time, there are 1 to 3 cases where newborns are suffering symptoms associated with opioid withdrawal. Well, Pamela Carbina is an OBGYN in Daytona Beach. Thank you so much for joining us, Pam.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Hillary Medlin. She's a young mother. She and her son went through detox right after he was born. Thank you so much, Hillary.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Dixie Morgie. She's the executive director of Healthy Start. Thank you so much for joining us, Dixie.
Thank you.
Hillary, I want to start with you. How's your son doing? He's 2 now, right?
Yes, he's amazing. He'll be 2 in September, actually. He goes to Easter Seals, which he went to at Project Warm. Mm-hmm. He's lovely. He's got amazing locks and curls, green eyes. He's just fascinated with everything right now.
And Project Warm was the program you went through after he was born?
Yes, we went there when he was 2 months old after I went to detox for 3 days, and we stayed there for 15 months.
Wow. Tell me about that project. What happens there?
I go through counseling, one-on-one group sessions. I went through trauma therapy. It's not mandatory, but I would like to go. Mm-hmm. And we just gained intimate relationships with women. We set up steps 1, 2, and 3 through any NA or AA fellowships. We did group projects with the women there, with the BHGs there, staff, any related projects inside and outside Warm.
So it's pretty intense.
It is.
How's the last 2 years been for you?
It's been up and down, just trying to get through the structured project of Warm and then coming out. Since Warm is so structured and routine and 15 months of it, and then now being on my own for 6 months, trying to get that structure of my own and another routine has been very challenging but manageable.
And you are now a peer recovery specialist in training with Healthy Start, so you're really a star student of this program, it looks like.
Yes, sir. It's been an amazing journey. I've been wanting to give back for a while, just seeing the mothers go up and down through their journey, knowing what I've been through, and wanting to just share my experience, strength, and hope with who's been going through the program, knowing that the struggle has been pretty much real, and there is hope out there, and there's people that care. There's mothers that have had their children taken away and reunification stories, that it can happen. And if you want it to happen, that it is hard, but there are people that care and that are nurturing and that will help you and provide for you.
Pam Carbina, what's your impression of this issue, that the issue of pregnancy and addiction, I guess? I mean, what are the numbers like now compared to the last time we spoke, which was back in 2015?
They've doubled, at least.
Wow.
At least that's what we have with our ICD-10 data.
And what is that?
Where hospitals document the presence of NAS in a baby and it's treated. I think probably...
And NAS is...
Neonatal abstinence syndrome. Hmm. When a woman is either using opioids illicitly, or if she is on methadone or buprenorphine in a maintenance treatment program, the baby is born having been used to that exposure. And there's really not an addicted baby per se. It's actually an exposure that the baby had and now needs to gradually wean from.
Mm-hmm.
And so these infants, depending on their genetics and the type of substances and how the quantity and the number of them, may spend anywhere from a couple of weeks to even a couple of months or more in a neonatal intensive care unit or pediatric intensive care unit, gradually weaning from their opioid exposure with small doses of either oral morphine or other medications, so that once the baby is comfortable off these medications, then they can leave the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very difficult for moms to maintain relationships, to nurse, to have the appropriate bonding when these babies are in the hospital like that. And while the standard of care historically has been, if women are addicted to opioids during pregnancy, they should be maintained on the opiates, a lot of places in the nation now are working with the idea of detox during pregnancy and having the babies born without needing maintenance therapy.
Is that dangerous?
I don't think so. I think there was some very poor data initially in the 10 years ago that suggested withdrawal or detox during pregnancy was dangerous for the infants. But what's really dangerous is continued use in high-risk environments where the women are using it intravenously or obtaining it through high-risk behaviors and having babies that receive a lot and then the next day none, and then the next day some, so that it's not consistent.
Mm-hmm.
That is certainly worse than maintenance therapy. But the ideal situation, in my opinion, would be to have a woman go through detox once and then be in a nurturing environment, either in residential or outpatient therapy.
But is it better for the detox to happen while the pregnancy is going on, or is it better for that to happen right afterwards? Like, what's the ideal situation?
Historically, we thought that it was better for mom and baby after delivery to detox together. And theoretically, that made sense because if the mom was maintained during pregnancy, she wouldn't exhibit high-risk behaviors. That doesn't translate into reality in any way or form nationwide, and certainly not in our counties in Central Florida. If you can identify a residential treatment center that can help with abstinence-based treatment, like Project Warm and Volusia Flagler area, I would support the detox, although it must be the woman's choice.
During pregnancy, though.
She is offered the opportunity in an ideal situation, and she can either choose the maintenance therapy, although there's no residential treatment centers in Volusia Flagler County for that, or she can choose the detox through SMA Pine Grove and then go to Project Warm. And that, I think, is probably ideal in terms of the baby being born without neonatal abstinence syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to, after graduation from an abstinence-based recovery residential center, we have to make sure that there is enough wraparound services for that mom and baby to maintain their recovery.
Now, what's dangerous about neonatal abstinence syndrome? This is, I mean, to put it in plain English, I guess, is it like when the baby essentially goes cold turkey?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
So what's the danger of that?
These babies are subject to fevers, seizures, they can't coordinate their sucking, so it's very difficult for them to eat. They have tremors and painful cramping. They're very inconsolable. It varies from baby to baby, but they require sometimes multiple medications to be comfortable and not to have seizures. And what's the real danger is if the babies go home before they exhibit symptoms and the system at large and the parents don't recognize that the baby is going through neonatal abstinence syndrome, an inconsolable baby in a stressful household is at risk for abuse or neglect.
Dixie Morgese, I want to bring you in on this conversation. You know, Pamela Carbina talks about a doubling of the number of pregnant and addicted folks in this area anyway. So when you look at those numbers, do you feel like there are the resources to help those people, and are they getting those resources?
Well, that's across the state of Florida. So the Florida numbers have doubled, although some of our counties are much higher than others. I think that the resources, it's the intensity of the resources that is not really available. Mm-hmm. When women leave treatment, that's when a lot of the stressors begin. So they leave a very structured environment and they have to figure out how to get housing, how to get childcare, how to get a job, how to get transportation. And so trying to help a woman stay clean and manage all those things, and sometimes an infant that may have medical needs that are extraordinary. They might be more than an average child, and so they have to manage pediatric appointments. And if they've been identified by the Department of Children and Families, then they're also trying to manage a case plan that requires timelines for getting all these things done. And so I think it's important to note that people don't wake up one day and say, I think I'm going to be an addict. Many women end up addicted because their ability to cope, because of maybe trauma or other circumstances, you know, are not real good. So there's always that risk when they leave treatment that those stressors start compounding and the coping that they were used to, which is to use, feels like an option. And even if it's just a moment, if they don't feel like there's hope for a way out, if they don't feel like they can pull all those things together, they have adequate support, then they're very high risk for relapse. So it's one of the things Healthy Start really works on is aftercare, helping mom learn how to manage an infant and how to parent. And the women are higher risk, we know, for postpartum depression or perinatal mood disorder. And, you know, the postpartum period, it's challenging enough for a mom who has everything. For some of the moms, finding those supports, making sure there are friends, making sure that they know where to find recovery resources, it's really critical. And so that's a loaded question that you asked, because that's a lot of capacity that's required to do those things. So it's multiple systems. It's not just substance abuse. It's not just medical. It's housing. It's childcare. It's all those kinds of things where really as a state, when we're operating at our best, all those systems are coordinating together to make sure that the pathway is clear for women after treatment.
Are we operating at our best right now, do you think?
I think in some models we are. For us, the capacity is challenging. We have some days where there may be four women that we're working with in aftercare, and it can take a whole week just to try to help those women get what they need, especially when there's been a relapse after they leave treatment and then they call in desperation and maybe the treatment center bed is not available for them and they're there with an infant and they've relapsed. So in that regard, I would say the capacity is not there. You know, in all honesty, it's not. And we work very diligently to try to find resources. But if you think about even just housing, just to house somebody in a place that does recovery housing is at least $120 to $150 a week.
Right.
So you have to come up with that money somehow to get a woman in a safe place so that you can work on some of those other things. If she's homeless, she's very high risk for being exploited, for human trafficking, for many situations that I don't think anyone in the community wants our women exposed to.
How did the state of emergency, that declaration, how did that help bring resources to this issue?
Well, I'm glad that you asked, because I think the governor proclaimed a state of emergency and it resulted in some of the money that had been earmarked to deal with the opioid crisis to the tune of about $27 million was accessed. But what we're finding as we're working with the managing entities that contract for services through substance abuse mental health money is that somehow money got reallocated. So there's now money that's being devoted toward what they call medication-assisted treatment, which mm-hmm. is what Dr. Carbiner was talking about, Subutex, Suboxone, methadone. And then Narcan, of course, we know when people are overdosing, being able to sustain their life or get them to a place where they can be saved is really important. But some of that money got displaced and other money for treatment got reallocated. So I know that in our community, Stuart Marchman Act, which is our biggest substance abuse treatment center, they're facing a huge cut. And we are also facing a cut because we have a grant from them. So the program we have for high risk for our moms that are struggling with opioid addiction is about to be cut. So mm-hmm. it's interesting. Somehow it didn't really translate into more money for the families we're working with.
Pam Carbiner, talking about Narcan, how does that fit into this whole picture of helping the pregnant and addicted? Like if somebody who's pregnant, they are treated with Narcan for some overdoses, what effect does that have on the unborn child, on the fetus?
Well, it will have the same effect as the mom in that it will displace the opioid, whatever, be it Dilaudid, heroin, fentanyl, from the mu receptors in the brain and encourage breathing mechanisms, which is what the problem is with people when they overdose.
Right.
They suppress their respiratory effort and they can just stop breathing and die from that. The baby is being provided oxygen and from the mom, so the baby is not at risk of, you know, having death unless the mother dies. But certainly rapid displacement will give the baby withdrawal, and it's hard to know what that baby feels in the short term acutely in the womb, and it's even harder to know what the interval exposures, you know, a ton of opioid, no opioid, an opioid antagonist, how that impacts the long-term development of that baby brain is really an unknown.
How does fentanyl, Pam Carbiner, complicate the issue? Because we hear stories about how much stronger fentanyl is. It's a more dangerous opioid, I guess. So are you seeing people who are pregnant who are addicted to fentanyl now rather than heroin?
Not intentionally. I mean, and as Dixie said, nobody intends to grow up and be an addict, let alone a pregnant addict or a addicted mother. And where the fentanyl is problematic is it's coming from overseas, fentanyl, carfentanyl, off on internet from China, and it's being used to cut the heroin locally so that since it's cheaper, they'll mix it with what is being sold illegally, and people will not know what it is that they have actually bought and what they're actually injecting. And it has such a much stronger potency that a person may think that they're using a certain amount that gives them a certain effect, and then they overdose. And if the mom overdoses and goes into respiratory depression and becomes hypoxic, that will directly impact that baby, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And in our county, we have had several deaths of pregnant women who have overdosed, and inadvertently it was probably a fentanyl overdose. And that's a tragedy we would like to avoid.
Hillary Medlin, is there a process of, encouraging pregnant and addicted to come to a program like Healthy Start? Like, are people always willing to come and see what there is to offer, or are sometimes people a little bit reluctant to get that help even if it's available?
There's always people that don't want to ask for help, advocating for yourself. There can always be that friend that wants to advocate for you. Like for me, for my personal experience, I never wanted to ask for help. I always wanted to do things my way. I always had it. But you can advocate for yourself by asking for help. And there's a lot of people out there that want to help you and provide the skills necessary for you.
And it sounds like there's a lot of patience required from folks who are helping people who are pregnant and addicted, or young mothers who are coming out of addiction, right? I mean, it's not just an easy one-step process.
No, definitely not. There's going to be multiple steps through recovery, you're going to become unmanageable. You're going to have the stressors. But as long as you have that nurturing to bring the stressors back down, because research shows if your stressors go up and you never have that nurturing to bring them down, any trigger, any loud noise, any thing that never brings the stressors down, you're always going to be in a high-intensity fight-or-flight mode.
I want to finish with you, Dixie Morgese. What do you think the biggest challenge is going to be in the next 12 months?
Well, I think something we haven't really talked that much about is that many of the women we work with have added health problems that come with drug use. And we've seen an increasing number of women with things like sepsis and heart problems, literally needing things like heart valve replacement, endocarditis, and needle-using behavior comes with a lot of other kinds of health problems. So I think part of the challenge is the medical community, and I think Dr. Carbiner can speak to this too. They're very reticent to get too involved because there's a lot of liability. A lot of times these are moms that unless you can really get them all the wraparound services, their compliance level isn't always very high, and so doctors and the medical community can be frustrated. I think that's a big challenge over the next 12 months because the numbers are growing higher, the medical issues are getting more complicated, and the workforce is getting, I think, you know, a bit of compassion fatigue. And so those would be some of the challenges I see facing us.
Pam Carbiner, do you see your colleagues, other folks in the medical profession, stepping up and doing what you're doing?
Not so far, no.
What's the key to getting them involved?
Education. Teach them to not be judgmental, to recognize that these are young people who come from all walks of life, who largely their addictions may have been iatrogenic, caused by well-meaning physicians who have given medications in greater amount than they should have, and by pharmaceutical companies who have proposed that these things are not addictive when they are. This is our bubonic plague, our cholera, our Spanish flu, and how our medical community and communities at large react to it is really going to show our mettle and how it will be how we are judged in the future.
Well, Pam Carbiner is an OBGYN in Daytona Beach. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Also joined by Hillary Medlin. She's a peer recovery specialist in training with Healthy Start of Flagler and Volusia Counties. Hillary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Dixie Morgese, Executive Director of Healthy Start, Flagler and Volusia County. Thank you so much, Dixie.
Thank you, Matthew.
Still to come.
A few years ago, they started staggering the coasters, so those near misses weren't as dramatic, and someone might say not as dangerous, just from flying debris from one to the other and whatnot. So some of the thrill has been taken off there.
Changes ahead for Orlando area theme park rides. If you missed an episode of Intersection, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or listen on the NPR One app. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. What does Universal have in store for the roller coaster formerly known as Dueling Dragons? Orlando Sentinel theme park reporter Dwayne Bevel says the future of that ride, one of his favourites, is shrouded in mystery. We caught up with Bevel, who started the conversation by explaining why his favourite time to hit the parks is well after the end of the summer crowds.
I like to go the week after Thanksgiving. So people have done their Thanksgiving visit. It's too early to start their Christmas visit, but the parks are kind of in Christmas mode already. So, yeah, and it's less humid. It's a more comfortable time to go.
Now, anybody who drives on I-4 over the last, you know, 6 months to a year has seen that new attraction getting built, and now it's open, of course, Volcano Bay. It's kind of interesting to have seen the mountain built, the substructure, and then the volcano take shape on top of that. How is that working out for Universal? Is it a popular attraction?
I'm going to say yes, they close for capacity a lot. I'm not exactly sure what they're considering their capacity. I think they may be ramping up a little. You know, it's like we're going to try to see if we can handle X amount when maybe it would hold X plus 50. And in July, they were expecting such a crowd. They blocked out their annual pass holders. And there have been indications that it continues to fill during the day. People are interested in new things, and I believe, let's see, August 1st, the pass holders are let back in. So we'll see if they get slammed then or if everybody's going back to school and it evens out.
And my understanding is they've got some new technology there as well with bracelets similar to what Disney's been doing. Is that right?
Right. Volcano Bay features a wearable technology that they call Tapu Tapu. And the idea is it's on your wrist like a watch. It makes reservations for the water slides. You can use it to unlock a locker. You can use it to pay for your meals. You don't have to carry money around with you. And it's something to adjust to. But I think people are getting the hang of wearable technology. But let's face it, most people are going for their first time. So there's a lot of questions. It's free. It's included in your Volcano Bay admission, and you do give it back at the end of the day. So it signals you when the ride has gone down. It signals you when it's your time to get on. It's very modern. It's the next step, I'd say.
So what else is new at Universal? I understand there's some changes to the Dragon Challenge thrill ride there. What's going on there?
Right. So Dragon Challenge is a roller coaster at Islands of Adventure. It's part of the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. It is original to the park, built in 1999, before there was a Wizarding World of Harry Potter. Universal last week announced they were going to retheme it. It wasn't going to be a Dragon Challenge anymore. Well, it's more than retheming. They're closing the coaster and replacing it with a thrill ride that hasn't been described so much, but we don't know exactly what they're doing to it. But I think the coaster as we know it is going away, and there will be a new family-friendly thrill ride, also Harry Potter themed. So September 4th, which is Labor Day, is the last day of Dragon Challenge. The dueling red and blue sides will be no more.
Is that one of your favorites? Do you enjoy taking that roller coaster, or have you enjoyed it?
I do enjoy the Dragon Challenge. They had a little issue where its big feature at the beginning was they're two separate sides, two completely different coasters, but intertwined. And so frequently it looked like you were about to hit the other coaster. A few years ago, they started staggering the coasters so those near misses weren't as dramatic, and someone might say not as dangerous just from flying debris from one to the other and whatnot. So some of the thrill has been taken off there, and now it just remains to see what will happen next.
I guess theme parks have been experimenting with virtual reality too, so there's probably a way to build in some of that thrill without the danger of some of those near misses, so to speak, if you can do it virtually.
Right. A lot of people are thinking it's going to be an indoor ride. We just don't know. Are they taking Dragon apart? That's my guess, but truly just a guess. They have not been too forthcoming. It'll be Potter themed. We'll see characters. It will be a coaster. I've talked to people who feel like it's going to be an indoor ride because that will be less noisy for the adjacent neighborhood. But that's a thought, but I can't say it's a fact at this point.
Dwayne Bevel, what about SeaWorld's sister park, Discovery Cove? Now, they're going to start allowing visitors to swim with sharks with an extra charge. What do you know about that? How is that going to be rolled out?
That's a good question. Discovery Cove has several things that are add-ons. And the two newest ones will be swimming with a shark and feeding rays. So they're trying to draw people in with things they haven't seen before there. So this will be an option. You can have your regular price. The price of Discovery Cove has a giant range. It's particularly seasonal. And Florida residents, if you pay attention, can do very well in September or October.
Is SeaWorld doing okay, though? Is the main park doing all right? I mean, they've had so much controversy they've had to battle over the last few years. How is that park doing now?
Well, attendance is down and income is down. So they're trying several things. They've rebooted the Kraken roller coaster to be virtual reality, just like you're talking about, a headset, optional, to tell a different story than we've been seeing there. They just remodeled the Dolphin Nursery, which is very user-friendly. It's very attractive. It draws people in to learn about conservation. And then next year, they're opening a big raft ride, family style, seats eight, drops something like 40 feet. And it's called Infinity Falls. It's back where they used to keep the Clydesdales. So, again, just trying to get your attention because there's a lot of competition in Orlando.
And speaking of some of that competition, Disney's rebooting some of their stuff as well. For example, at Epcot, relaunching the space attraction. What's going to be new about that once that thing gets up and running again?
Well, Mission Space, this was part of Disney's giant announcement of 14 things that are going to be happening in Disney World the next few years. And the first thing that we come to is the new film inside Mission Space. And again, it's two-sided. One side is in orbit around Earth. This is film. And then the other side is more intense, and it's a launch to Mars. And that will happen August 13th, which is also the last day for Ellen's Energy Adventure, which is right nearby Mission Space, and also the last day for the Great Movie Ride over at Disney's Hollywood Studio, which is one of the original, maybe the last original ride from Disney MGM Studios, which opened in, 1988, I think. So change is in the air, and it's happening quickly.
Dwayne Bevel, you've spent so long, covering theme parks. You know these rides inside out and backwards. So, I mean, do you have a sense of nostalgia or sort of missing some of the old school rides when they get rebooted?
Well, there's certainly people who do. It's kind of piece by piece to me. I personally like the Great Movie Ride, but I'm anxious to see what could go in there. Ellen's Energy Adventure, super dated. And it felt old when you were in it, so it makes sense to me, and generally people are nostalgic for things that are steeped in Disney lore or sort of Mickey-driven, and, Ellen DeGeneres doesn't quite fall into that category. I was at Ellen's Energy Adventure this weekend, and there may be 80 people on it, so I don't think that there's going to be too much outcry there.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of space, there's also something afoot with the entire Star Wars park in development. What can you tell me about that one?
So at the announcement, they gave us the name of what Star Wars Land. We've been calling it Star Wars Land for years now, but it's going to be Star Wars Galaxy's Edge. That will be at Hollywood Studios and out in California as well. We'll be opening that in 2019. What really got people talking was the talk of this Star Wars hotel, a very immersive experience. It's going to be somewhere at Disney World. It's not clear exactly where, how big, how much it will cost. They just kind of said, hey, you're going to spend a couple of days here and you'll wear a costume and you'll drive the Millennium Falcon. So that kind of got people riled up. Even people I know who don't care much about Disney or really even care that much about Star Wars are talking about this and they want to go. I think it's going to be a very much in demand sort of property. And, who knows, maybe we'll see them elsewhere in the world as well.
Well, Dwayne Bevel, theme park reporter with the Orlando Sentinel, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Alana Campbell. You can find us online at WMFE.org. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.